Hi, my name is Brett Vinod, and I'm the host of School Sucks Podcast. Please consider the following shows when you go to vote for the 2010 Podcast Awards this year. In the Best Produced category, School Sucks Podcast. In the People's Choice category, Free Domain Radio. In the Cultural Arts category, Taryn Lupo's Pirates of Savannah. In the Politics category, Free Talk Live or Wheels Off Liberty Podcast. In the Education category, School Sucks or Free Domain Radio. In comedy, The Joe Rogan Experience. And in the health and fitness category, Wes Bertrand and Kevin Koskela's Healthy Mind, Fit Body podcast.
Can I just cut in here for a second?
Sure you can, fuckface. Go ahead.
Personally, I think all of these people should be down at Gitmo, hanging upside down by their ankles, with a rag in their mouth and blindfolded, while a guy in a black leather gimp costume pours a gallon of water after gallon of water all over their face, while I jerk off in the corner.
And I stand next to you, rubbing my nipples.
Jesus, you guys are sick. I have a feeling this is probably going to be our last collaboration. And we're out of time.
Okay, that's a wrap. Wow, that was really terrible. Hey, you know, before you guys go, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Shoot. Are you guys, like, friends in real life? Like, do you hang out with each other?
Yeah, you could say that we've actually developed a bit of a bromance based on our mutual love for aggressing against peaceful people. It's almost like we're sharing a brain. You know, like, we complete each other's sentences. Like, I'll say, I wish I had total control over... And then Barry will say, everyone, see, that's how it works. Anyway, so, Bill Clinton and my dad are about to tee off. You want to see if we can catch up with them and make it a foursome?
Yeah, sounds great.
Cool. Oh, there's one problem. The country club where my dad is a member, they do not allow African Americans to play on the course. But I'm thinking, since you are a mulatto, maybe they will let you play nine. Instead of 18.
Jesus.
What, does that make me a racist for saying something like that?
Nope. Just a retard.
But, George, I think that's why the American voters identify with you so much, and that's why they want to have a beer with you. And, of course, that's why they need someone like me to take care of them.
All right, guys, thanks for coming in.
Hey, everybody, this is Brett, and today... is July 11th, 2011, and hey, guess what? For over a year, I have been saving little scraps, in some cases medium size and big scraps, of audio, things that I originally cut out of School Sucks Podcast because I decided they were not good enough for the final cut of the show. And today, lucky you, you're going to get to hear it all in one giant shitty compilation. Now, you might be asking, Brett, why would you make us listen to your crap? Well, I'll say this. In the past, I've put things out that I wasn't really thrilled with, and then, you know, somebody would write to me and say, oh, I appreciated that, or I enjoyed that, and I was totally surprised. Maybe you'll have an experience like that today. Probably not. And I should also say this. Aside from a few silly moments, most of the material in today's show was originally discarded because I decided at the time that it was too negative. And... something I've been thinking about a lot lately is turning another corner with the show and producing something that is more positive and constructive. I think we've done all that we can to shine a spotlight on the problems of the government education system. I would really like to start talking more and more about solutions on this show. And if you can make it through 90 minutes of these rants, you'll get to hear Jamie Crane and me plan an episode of Wheels Off Liberty. This is behind-the-scenes audio. So, lucky you. Big day for you. New shows are coming soon. Thank you very much for listening, and take care.
Well, do-do-do-do-do-do. Oh, hey there, kids. Are you like me, meaning that you enjoy fun and excitement, and you also only like to be moving in a primarily forward direction? Do you like using that head of yours to smash all of the bricks and the wall? Well, then I have a couple of suggestions that you might find helpful. There's plenty of other things you can do besides playing Nintendo all day. One is listening to School Sucks Podcast. It's kind of the same.
You know what? This is really stupid. This is really stupid. Yeah! Right? Everybody agreed that the best way to solve problems is with a hammer. Hey, is that a dirty window? Yeah, let's try a hammer. Ah, now there's glass on the street outside. Oh, a car just drove through it. Got a flat tire. So the car needs to be repaired. Try a hammer. Geez, this poor guy's car is destroyed. He can't get to work anymore. It's all smashed up. What can we do to help him? Now, let's see how he feels about getting hit with a hammer. We don't have debates over what the tool should be. It's just how much should we use it and where. Well, wait a minute, everybody. Hammers are can be kind of dangerous and might not be the best tool for solving every problem. Okay, then, smart guy, what the fuck are we going to use? What, do you want to use a butter knife? This guy wants to use a butter knife.
And why don't we start out the show today, some good news, even though it's unrelated to everything else we're going to be discussing. The Wheels Off Liberty crew will be at the 2011 Porcupine Freedom Festival. The loyal fans of that terrible podcast have raised an adequate amount of money to help get the operation up to Lancaster, New Hampshire. And we are going to be doing a live episode from the Porcupine Freedom Festival. And in case you haven't been following along, I have been filling in as a co-host on that show. I am in no way responsible for that show's content. Let me repeat that. I am in no way responsible for that show's content. But right now, the plan is four of us will do this podcast from the Porcupine Freedom Festival, Rogers Campground in Lancaster, New Hampshire. You should go. I said that last year, so I hope you can make it this year. Anyway, the live show at Porkfest will include me, Taryn Lupo, who is the author of the book Pirates of Savannah, a book that I have not read. I'm not going to lie to you. But I've heard wonderful things, very, very positive reviews. Somebody I know actually has a copy of it, and I have thumbed through it. And it looks really interesting. It has illustrations, and illustrations help in books. I think that's okay to say. Because after all, most of us are graduates of the government school. So little helping hand with pictures, not always such a bad thing. Book also has a beautiful cover, which if you can't read at all, it will still look great on your coffee table. So think about that. Taryn also used to do the Low Country Liberty Report, and I encourage you to learn more about his work. Also participating will be George. You can learn more about his talents at mandrick.com, M-A-N-D-R-I-K.com. George runs a wonderful agorist business. He is best known for his baklava, but we saw at Porkfest last year that he can make all kinds of fabulous food, and I think he did baklava wrapped in... Anyway, George is great, and he'll be there, and he'll participate. He actually was on one of the best episodes of Wheels Off Liberty ever when he filled in as a host. He was very, very entertaining, talented, entertaining, handsome, hairy. Guy's got it all. And, of course, last but not least, the guy who makes Wheels Off Liberty, Wheels Off Liberty, Jamie Crane. I think you'll find it very entertaining if you have the time and a kind of toilety sense of humor. I recommend it. So the four of us will be doing a show. I really look forward to that, to meeting Jamie, seeing George again, seeing Taryn again. That will just be a terrific time. I encourage you to attend. Today we're adults. We're in line at the airport, blindly obeying somebody who wants to go through our pockets and our belongings because they have a uniform on, even though the last uniform they wore probably said Burger King on it. Our balls in their hands, interpret that however you like, as so many reassure themselves
that all of this is for their own good. Why recognize a pattern? Why stop and think for a minute and see that as long as this weapon is available to vicious, greedy, thoughtless, myopic monsters who want to wield it, well, the defenseless will be exploited. Even in the article, the author implied that there needs to be public spending to improve institutions. More power to the government. God, it's such a hard meme for some reason for people to break. But that's what got us. That's every step to where we are today was more deference to these quote-unquote authorities. So, my generation, that this article was pretty much about, I was a junior in high school when that was written. We're through that part, right? Now we just have to worry about the IRS and the TSA and 1,000 other alphabet agencies that want to tell us what to do and threaten us and explain how we have some kind of defect if noncompliance occurs. But the kids of today, man, it's so much worse. All of that stuff talked about in the article, I mean, school sucked, but that was, like, hardly palpable to me. Like, I didn't feel respected. I didn't feel that I was being treated with dignity. I didn't feel that I was being addressed honestly. But there was hardly any drug. I maybe knew 3 kids in my whole high school who were on some kind of prescription drugs. Children of the State, Part 3, the S.A. My dad was being, like, patient with me, and ultimately we concluded by saying, this was interesting. We need one generation of parents who will raise their children without aggression, without punishment, without dangling rewards, without disrespect, without subjecting them to these insane religious dogmas, without subjecting them to these government indoctrination camps. And then the aggression, the violence that so many people just accept in their daily lives will become intolerable. And hopefully, it will peacefully fade out of existence. That's kind of the plan, if you like plans. And he looked at me kind of somber but curious, and he said, "So, I'm guessing that you don't think you and your brothers were that generation." And I answered, honestly, I said, "No. You know, like, Dad, I'm sure you did better than your parents did. In fact, I know he did better than his parents did. Certainly his mother, from whom he disconnected himself. But I was very frank, and I said, we're setting a higher standard for the future." And he accepted that, you know, and I said, that's the best answer. That's where this has to start. Don't ask me about the roads, right? They're already all there. The way that the training wheels will come off in the future is a reevaluation, a revolution in the approach to raising, educating children. So that should be the focus, right? Now I said, I kind of got off track there, but my brothers, who are young, it was very easy to convince them. They don't have any emotional stake in any of this. They've dumped very little money into the tax system, into the Social Security system. They're not counting the days till retirement where they're going to get these government checks. So it was very easy for them to emotionally disconnect themselves from these beliefs that are pounded into our heads. Older people can't do that. If you're at the airport
and you're protesting the TSA, like I talked about before. And there's a group of people up there in these costumes that are going to treat you like a criminal, that are going to disrespect you, they're going to humiliate you. And 100 feet before where they are, there's a group of people holding signs that say, hey, we think what's happening up there is wrong, and we'd like to see you and everybody else receive better treatment. When the people in the costumes are the good guy, and you, the person with the sign, taking, you know, time out of your schedule to go there and do that, maybe even risk being arrested or harassed by the police, are the bad guy? Well, that's kind of fucked. I'm sorry. So those probably aren't the people we should be trying to reach out to. Young people get this stuff, especially if they're in school. The first thing I want to do today is read a little email that I received regarding the last show. It was actually a comment on Podomatic. And it goes like this. Brett, you're a jerk. If you display the same arrogance and condescension at family gatherings that you do in your podcast, it's no wonder your relatives don't want to listen to you. It doesn't matter if you're right or not. I've listened to almost all of your podcasts. I agree with much of what you say. But you come across as condescending and arrogant. I'm right, and so obviously, that anyone who disagrees with me must be deceiving himself or a total moron. That's the attitude you display in your podcasts. People don't like arrogant jerks. The ideas you're promoting are very different. Put those two things together and it's no surprise that you turn some people off. Try meditation or something. You need to deliver your message with more honey and less vinegar. Okay. Whenever I start talking about these issues with somebody new, I would like to think, I really believe, that I am being polite and inquisitive. It's, you know, I try to keep in mind the whole Socratic approach, knowing that I know nothing. In other words, blank slate, let's start from scratch, convince me. And that's the opening approach. In the past, I will admit that as the conversation goes on, within, you know, an hour or over the course of several years with some people, I will accept their invitation to match their antagonism towards me, right? Like, you never start out being a dick to somebody, right? But if they're a dick to you and the conversation continues, I've had a habit of kind of falling into that negativity in the past. The way I talk on the show is because it's a show. Like, this show is nothing. It's pointless if it's not entertaining. And I do admit that a lot of times I'm kind of playing up a certain tone in an attempt to keep people engaged. But this wouldn't be how I would, you know, have a conversation about these issues with somebody that I was trying to convince. The other thing is, like, this show is not some kind of sacrifice that I'm making for a cause, right? I do this show for me. This is an outlet. It is a release. It has been very liberating to have a forum to discuss these issues and my experience. This is stuff that was bottled up for a long time, and as it explodes out in these MP3s, yeah, I guess I can sound like kind of a jerk sometimes. But let's be clear. I'm not doing this show so people will like me. If you put this show on a CD and gave it to everybody in America, every adult in America, over 90% of people would absolutely hate me. This show is a release. This show is an exercise in personal freedom. Something that I did not have for a long time in my professional life. And if I, you know, my attitude has always been, if I can do things that excite me and that help me and can help or inspire or educate other people in the meantime, that's what I should do. And yeah, maybe there is some vanity, you know, in the motivation a little bit. I think that was part of the reason why I wanted people. I wanted to be a teacher in the first place. I like to talk and have people listen. But yeah, I you know, I have a lot of stuff that I'm trying to get out about my own personal experience here as well. For a long time, I was a whore. Now you're saying, Brett, what do you mean you were a whore? Like a whore, whore? No, not like a whore, whore. Like, I was not very discriminating about the kind of work that I would do. Obviously, early in my career, I used to be involved in some pretty nasty stuff, willingly, and I would rationalize it. Even when I started tutoring, if somebody, you know, called this company that I worked for and said, this is my son or daughter, and they need tutoring in this for this many hours a week, I'd just go do it. I would say, yeah, I'll take them. Oh, what do they live, 20 minutes away from me? Yep, I'll take them as a client. I used to tutor this boy. We'll call him Buddy. He went to Catholic school. And my job was to meet with him 3 days a week for an hour and a half each day and make sure that he did his homework because he didn't like to do his homework for his Catholic high school. If his homework was religion, I'd help him with it. And we would sit there and read Leviticus and then answer questions about it. That was like such a conflict for me. But I did it quietly and politely. Do you know how many parent-teacher meetings, how many IEP meetings I've sat through, all of the discussions that I've had with parents after I finished tutoring their son or daughter where I couldn't say what I wanted to say, I couldn't tell them or share with them what I wanted to? Oh, it's agonizing. Agonizing. So this show has provided just a tremendous release. And that's one of the reasons why I do it. It's not a sacrifice I'm making for the children. I hope it helps. I hope it's useful. But, I mean, these are, like, the things that I've always wanted to say. Like these are the things that in my head, I'm sitting in a meeting, like, nodding with my mouth closed. And in my mind, oh, say this, say this, say this. But you can't, so here I can. And I do. And that's what School Sucks Podcast is. Why do I feel guilty about my career? Right? Because I made these decisions to comply, to go along, to do all the things that I've done in education in the last 10 years. Because, you know, like I pointed out earlier, tutoring has this stuff too. So this email that I get really has me thinking. It has me thinking about motivations. Why did I become a teacher in the first place? I already said this. I like to talk. I like history. I like to talk about history and have people listen and be like, oh, yeah, that's interesting. Well, teaching in like a school certainly provides anybody with those interests with a captive audience. I have to be honest. I never got the same satisfaction from tutoring that I got from teaching in these shitty schools. I never walked into, even if you think about my philosophy of what education should be, I never walked into one of these one-on-one sessions with the same kind of excitement and enthusiasm that I had when this group of kids, many of whom did not give a shit about what I was talking about, walked into my American history class.
And that, you know, that explains why every solution to every problem, and usually, you know, the solution is just the segue to the next problem, is more of the same. More of what we've been doing, but harder. I mean, the school will pay lip service to these things. Like, when you go in for a meeting, they're like, oh, yes, we will make accommodations and modifications for this child. We will, yes, we'll put them on an individualized plan. It's very weird. There are all these, like, old British men drinking tea with these twill suits on. But, yeah, I mean, all I've really seen is lip service, so... They can talk a good game, but what would be nice is if the parents were more involved with the, you know, individual educational needs, interests, weaknesses, struggles of their own children. But what I've realized is that most parents don't see that as their job. They want to believe that these kids are in good hands, and usually the only time their ears perk up is when report cards come, when these disinterested, incompetent, you know, educational professionals in the school rate the intellectual abilities of that student with 1 of 5 letters. And I'm kind of like, you know, kind of questioning the whole tutoring thing in general. When I went and I worked at the Scholars Academy, I really felt like this was the most consistent, as far as the way I could spend my time, as far as the way my professional life could go. This was the most consistent with my educational philosophy. You know, working with homeschoolers, working with these kids in this very decentralized, student-led, student-centered environment, That's a very, very hard thing to create as a tutor. It's a very, very hard thing to create in the facilitator of that SAT class, which I think you will have heard by the time this is out.
From freemarketmojo.com, LA Times versus Unions by Ariel Goldring. Alex Tabarrok calls the LA Times investigative report on teacher quality groundbreaking, arguing that it should have been done decades ago. In case you somehow missed it, here's what the LA Times did. The Times obtained 7 years of math and English test scores from the Los Angeles Unified School District and used the information to estimate the effectiveness of LA teachers, something the district could do, but has not. The Times used a statistical approach known as value-added analysis, which rates teachers based on their students' progress on standardized tests from year to year. Each student's performance is compared with his or her own in past years, which largely controls for outside influences often blamed for academic failure, poverty, prior learning, and other factors. In coming months, the Times will publish a series of articles and a database analyzing individual teachers' effectiveness in the nation's second-largest school district. The first time, experts say, such information has been made public anywhere in the country. Among the most interesting findings, contrary to popular belief, the best teachers were not concentrated in schools in the most affluent neighborhoods, nor were the weakest instructors bunched in poor areas. Rather, these teachers were scattered throughout the district. The quality of instruction typically varied far more within a school than between schools. Although many parents fixate on picking the right school for their child, it matters far more which teacher the child gets. Teachers had 3 times as much influence on students' academic development as the school they attend. Yet parents have no access to objective information about individual instructors, and they often have little say in which teacher their child gets. While most of the data is still unavailable, the LA Times plans on releasing information on individual teachers. The graphic above, which I know that you cannot see, I'll put a picture of that in the show notes, is not an illustration. It is real information on real teachers. According to the LA Times, after a single year with teachers who ranked in the top 10% effectiveness, students scored an average of 17 percentile points higher in English and 25 points higher in math than students whose teachers ranked in the bottom 10%. Students often backslid significantly in the classrooms of ineffective teachers, and thousands of students in the study had 2 or more ineffective teachers in a row. Knowing which teachers are best can only help educators understand how to train teachers properly. Secretary of Education Arne Duncan has already applauded the Times piece, saying parents have the right to know how effective their children's teachers are. He said he, quote, hoped such data could be used to identify superior teachers that others can learn from, as well as those who need professional development or should be counseled out of the profession, unquote. The problem for teachers is that if we identify the best of the teachers, we will simultaneously identify the worst of the teachers. For teachers' unions, this is a serious dilemma. After all, they are tasked with protecting the interests of teachers, not students. After learning of the analysis in the database last week, union leaders began making automated calls to teachers objecting to publication. In the Friday evening call, Duffy said the database was, quote, an irresponsible, offensive intrusion into your professional life that will do nothing to improve student learning. Our attorneys are looking into the legalities of this database, he said in the recorded message. This is part of a continuing attack on our profession, and we must continue to fight back on all fronts. On Sunday, Duffy declined to talk about any legal action or other protests besides a boycott. I'll keep that to myself, he said. For now, the union is simply calling for a boycott of the paper. Teachers boycotting a newspaper that seeks the truth. Well done, guys. The end. Okay. Now, this is a story that has multiple layers. At the top, at the surface, what is most visible, I think this is obvious, it almost goes without saying. The teachers' union, as is the case with any public employee union, is going to fight against any effort that attempts to measure the quality or the effectiveness of the people that they are protecting. Now, this is not just true with education. And we should point out, and I don't point it out enough, there are a lot of people who go into this profession for noble reasons. As far as what's in their head at the time, I mean, they don't understand, you know, oh, well, this I get paid because somebody gets threatened. They really just see this is the way that education works, and this is how I can participate in it. So, you know, once they're made aware of the whole taxation is theft thing, people get threatened with the theft of their house twice a year to make the salary possible, and then they continue to do it. That's another story. But I really believe that people do not get into this profession, like I've said so many times before, because they can get a $1,500 raise every year, no matter how bad they suck at their job. A lot of these people, they don't say, wow, I'm dumb and I don't want to work hard, so this is what I'll do. But unionized government jobs tend to attract people, and more importantly, retain people who are incompetent. I don't know what percentage of public school teachers, even by the standards of what it means to be a good public school teacher, would really be considered incompetent. But the union, if they're not saying, come look at what we can do, yes, there's something that should raise eyebrows right there. And at this point, I think it's pretty clear, like, I'm not a pro-teachers union guy. I was going to read the letter that A.J. Duffy, the president of this teachers union in California, wrote to the L.A. Times. It was 2.5 pages long. I read the first two paragraphs, and I said, this is absolutely excruciating. If I read this whole thing in an episode of School Sucks podcast, that'll be like the worst episode ever. So I scrapped that from the show. And these people, they are just the most self-righteous drama queens.
Boo, this is a noble profession, and what about the children?
Not a pro-teachers union guy. I'm not a pro-public employee union guy. Because the whole theory of working for the government, of being a public servant, is that the public is your management. That you are answerable to the public. In theory. Now, I have no problem with the idea of collective bargaining in private industry. I've worked in private industry my entire life. or in private schools my entire life. And, you know, I remember, even as a teacher, having problems with things the administration did. There was, you know, years ago, I was the lead teacher at this specialized program in this residential school, and we were having a lot of administrative meetings about restructuring the program, and I'm hoping this is something that I can talk about on the show in the future. If I can work it in, I will. But I remember being in this meeting, probably like 2005, and just being really, really frustrated about many aspects of what were going on. And it was, you know, the executive director of the school, the clinical director of the school, the residential director of the school, and a couple clinical people. And in the middle of me sort of, you know, complaining about what was going on, the executive director cut me off and he said, "Somebody else can do your job." Now, he wasn't being totally unsympathetic to what I was saying. It was probably, you know, I was younger at the time. I probably wasn't being as tactful as I should in a meeting like that. And this guy was a dick, but he was right. There was somebody else in that town at that time who probably, with just a little bit of training, could have done that job better than me. I made a voluntary arrangement with this school. It was not a good place to work. I have a lot of problems with a lot of things that happened there. But at the time, I made a voluntary agreement that for this amount of money, I will perform these tasks and I will accept these responsibilities. I knew what I was getting into. I had asked for this job in this very, very difficult part of the school because I thought it would move my career forward. Nobody was holding a gun to anybody's head in the administration of that school to issue me a paycheck every week. But in a public employee union, the opposite is true. Gun rarely gets held to anybody's head. The gun rarely even ever comes out. But that doesn't mean that the paycheck isn't based on the gun. So what's the point of collective bargaining? In a voluntary relationship, people can get together and they can go to the management and they can say, "We want A, B, and C." And the manager can say, "All right, you're all fired." But that's the risk they take. Public employees cannot be fired. And this is one of the reasons, one of the many reasons, why the government continues to grow and grow and grow and become less and less and less efficient. Not that it ever could be efficient even in theory, but just, you know, right over the southern border of New Hampshire, where I live, we have the state of Massachusetts. On the other side of the Iron Curtain, there is Massachusetts. Now, in Massachusetts, they set up all of these tolls decades ago as a temporary measure to help pay off the cost of the highway system in that state. The state highway system, the toll booth employees were unionized. It was no longer a temporary measure, and the average salary of somebody who sits in a booth and collects quarters and says, "Thank you, have a nice day," the average salary of those workers in Massachusetts is over $60,000 today. And today, what is the purpose of these toll booths?
To pay the salaries, basically, of the toll booth workers. Over 60% of the revenue from the tolls. That's what it's for.
That's a public employee union. So anyway, why am I saying all this? You're going to find this interesting. I actually find myself having just a little bit of sympathy, maybe not for the union spokespeople or frontmen, but for the teachers that these unions are protecting. Bear with me. An important question is, how effective are these tests as measurement tools for teachers? My attitude and criticism towards the current public education system is largely based on my own personal experience working as an educator. But it is also based on a principle. The principle that the initiation of force is wrong. Aggression against other people is wrong. There is no privilege, there is no custom, there is no magic spell that makes it okay for any one individual to initiate aggression
against any other. It is based on the principle of self-ownership, that people own themselves and that they have the freedom to make their own choices as far as their time, their body, and the products of their labor are concerned.
And on my show in the past, I have to admit that I've missed few opportunities to criticize the people who work within the government education system, an institution that must continuously violate the non-aggression principle and the idea of self-ownership for its very existence. Today, I would like to come to the defense of two of these people. The first is a man named... He is a Florida high school football coach, and here is his story. From the Daytona Beach News Journal, September 6, 2010. Prostitution sting nets mainland coach. Dateline Daytona Beach. Mainland High School's the winningest football coach in Volusia County history was arrested Saturday night during a prostitution sting, police said. 68 was charged with a misdemeanor count of soliciting a prostitute, Daytona police said Sunday. When reached by phone in his Daytona Beach Shores home Sunday morning, said he, quote, was told I really shouldn't comment, unquote, and declined to answer questions. The prostitution sting was part of an effort by police conducted in response to business owners and citizens complaining, isn't that always the case, about street-level prostitution, according to a press release Sunday. Police Chief Michael Chitwood provided some details about the arrest in an interview Sunday. He approached an undercover officer and engaged her in a conversation about sex for $50, Chitwood said. Everything was recorded on video. According to a police report of the arrest, drove into a parking lot and pulled up next to the undercover officer and offered $50 for sex. After agreeing, the officer arrested was the first of six men to be arrested in the sting operation, which was organized in an area of the beachside along State Route A1A, where prostitution activities have increased, Chitwood said. Chitwood said he was told the coach started praying after his arrest. Quote, he was saying, Our Father. Who is married and has five adult children, was booked into the Volusia County Branch Jail and released at 5:30 a.m. Sunday, after posting $500 bail, records show. Chitwood said he's met with a dozen times to work with high-risk students at Mainland. He said he was particularly disappointed in the poor judgment of a man he respects who has spent, quote, a lifetime working with kids. Now, the article does continue, and it details Mr.'s career and accomplishments as a high school football coach. But I think you get the point with what I've read already. And while it is impossible for me to come to Mr.'s defense, considering the fact that he was married and that he is supposed to be a positive role model in the lives of young people, I did suggest at the beginning that this presentation would provide some defense or some support for this first of two characters who engaged in acts that are considered reprehensible. And of course, yes, I think that going to a prostitute behind the back of your spouse is reprehensible. I do want to offer some support and some appreciation. At the beginning of the article, it said that this man was 68 years old. All right, let me address him. Mr. In this article, it said that you were 68 years old, which means that you probably have more than 40 years of experience in the culture of public school. Sir, congratulations on your courage in this incident, in trying to achieve what you want or what you need through voluntary means. You are a role model to your coworkers.
Because though you've been so used to for so long, no matter what you did, just getting a raise every year, not having to worry about getting fired, the taxpayers being extorted for more and more money year after year, and having that money handed over to you to coach football, the whole time resting easy knowing that your union would protect you for just about anything you did. That must have been one sweet life of bliss and entitlement. You could have taken the lessons from your career and tried to apply them to this situation where you, I don't know, kidnap some woman and force yourself on her. You could have raped or sexually assaulted somebody, but you didn't. You tried to establish a contract. I have $50. I want sex. Can we make a deal? Sir, good job. I hope others in your profession can learn from your courage and your dignity in this matter. On this night, despite the consequence, the guilt, the remorse that it brought to you, the pain that it might have brought to your family, and the shock that it might have brought to the community, thank you for not participating in or benefiting from aggression against innocent people. And of course, then I guess we do have the question of where you got the $50. Moving on.
That being said, I just finished working with one of my favorite students, and I'm feeling particularly energized because of that. He's currently working on his senior English project, where students can pick a topic of their choice. And there was a list of a bunch of books and authors that could be used. Anthem was one of them. That was the book we chose. So we just spent the last 20 minutes or so watching some videos of Ayn Rand and learning a little bit about her philosophy, which he found very intriguing. And very eye-opening. It was amazing what we accomplished in just a half an hour. But I kind of, this is not something I do all the time, but I kind of sold him on the idea of Anthem. I said, listen, there's tons of resources for this book online. I guarantee you we can find an audiobook if you want to get through the reading part quickly. There's a PDF, so when we're actually writing the paper, we can go in and copy and paste, like quotes and stuff. So we downloaded the audiobook. It was like, 2 hours long. It took us just a minute to download. Now he's putting it on his iPod. And, I said that this is a great book. And Rand is an author who is becoming increasingly relevant in the world that we live in today for a number of reasons. And I gave him a sort of a short overview as to why that is. And he was really excited about the idea. And he was really excited about the objectivist's philosophy. So, cool. I thought that was very cool. Now, today we're going to talk about the opposite. You know, the idea of, or Rand's ideas of, you know, you live for yourself and you have no right to ask anybody to expend their resources for your sake. You have no right to ask somebody else to live for you, to work for you, to produce for you. Well, if you look at the news, a lot of people are not buying into that idea. They think that if you have a kind of a special job where you work, quote unquote, for the children, you can basically demand whatever you want from other people. And the reason why I want to talk about this again, initially, when this whole Wisconsin thing happened, I wanted to avoid the whole subject, right? We've been over this. The culture of the unionized public workforce, the psychology that I think goes into wanting to, work in these schools. I think, a lot of these people might have good intentions. But there's also that problem of, never realizing, how much you're imposing on other people and a lot of the things in, that I see in the school as far as the mistreatment of kids is concerned, where, you know, these people who are just so petty and insignificant and tiny in their own lives act like these big imposing figures over these young children. I really saw this at this elementary school that I was just going in and out of. I think that was another thing that I didn't like about this work, was actually being in that environment. It's very upsetting. But I didn't feel like that there was anything really in this Wisconsin story that was going to move the conversation of School Sucks Project forward. But this is a big issue, and I just find myself being more and more attracted to it and wanting to cover some aspects of it. And I'm really disappointed how many young people have gravitated to the cause of these teachers. I find that very disconcerting. And, of course, I'm also a little bit troubled that initially I had a student who was willing to come on the show and talk about it. And when I told him I'm much more interested in talking to students than teachers, he just disappeared. And, you know, I sent him a follow-up email. I got no response. I got no response from about 15 others. And that's upsetting to me. I thought that these ideas were so attractive to young people that all they had to do was be exposed to them. And they would get them. They would grab them. They would embrace them. And so this is kind of a wake-up call as to, you know, how deep and dark this indoctrination is, that at 16 years old, you already can't grab these kids and pull them out of there and say, oh, no, what about this? And this is going on even while nature is screaming at them. Like the case with this boy Matt that I'm talking about, throwing hair at his face. You are not a child anymore. And being in that adult body and having that adult intellect, in many cases, an intellect that might be superior to most adults that are imposing things on this young person. Well, boy, that's the setup to accept that kind of treatment for most people for the rest of their lives. Oh, sure, you might look like an adult. You might feel and sound like an adult. But I'm going to need you to rent this sticker for us to put on your windshield so we know that you're safe. It's a sticker that we give you when you're being safe. Oh, sure, you might look and feel like an adult. We're going to need you to take your pants down. It's for your safety. Sure, it's humiliating, but it's for your safety. Also, we want, you know, control over what you can put in your own body. What kind of dried plants you're allowed to have. It's all just for your safety, because we know best. You might hurt yourself. If it wasn't for us, you would just be hurting yourself and others. So you're welcome. Most politicians, I read this recently, I'll try to source it in the show. Actually, I think it might have been in the new Zeitgeist movie that I just watched. Most politicians running for public office, especially people running for president, they speak to the American public at a sixth grade level.
4,000 people converge on the New Hampshire Capitol to protest a budget they call unfair.
It's drastic. We're being scapegoated because they need a target.
And immoral.
This is a moral concern. The poor and the vulnerable take priority in any society.
The House passed a $10.2 billion spending plan Thursday that's significantly smaller than the governor's plan and stands to cripple the state employees union.
I think the budget goes too far. I think the policies reach far beyond what they need to reach.
The most controversial amendment would make state workers at-will employees at the end of their current contracts. The union's collective bargaining rights are lost if new deals are not in place by that deadline.
At midnight, on a given date, the contract will expire with all the terms and conditions and benefits associated with it. What are the firefighters and police supposed to do at 12:01? Go home?
I want my money.
The budget also draws ire from mental health workers and advocates for the elderly and disabled for its cuts to services and changes to Medicaid.
So all the kids were at school, so they weren't available to be marched out as props to pull at people's heartstrings. Did anybody bring any poor or vulnerable?
She wants to be funded. She wants to have the supports that she needs to have a quality of life. She's been waiting. It's okay.
Inside the State House, the gallery was cleared and closed to the public for several hours after an outburst from firefighters who'd come inside to watch the debate.
They kicked us out, and we left, and we're not leaving now. We're going to stand here all day.
They were let back in to see the budget pass, 243 to 124. Republican leaders say it's a measure that's balanced and fair to all.
The best welfare for the people of New Hampshire is a private sector job. And we have to return those jobs to New Hampshire.
The budget now heads to the Senate, where not one legislator, Republican or Democrat, has said they will support the bill, especially the amendment on collective bargaining. A fight is in store for this budget. In Concord, New Hampshire, Lauren Collins, NACN.
Okay, so let's look at the facts of this. First of all, the word cuts being thrown around with people crying in the background can have an emotional impact on a lot of people. Let's understand this word cuts in the magical language of government. Usually what that means is, first of all, when we think about our own lives, getting a pay cut or a cut in our allowance or cutting back our spending, we think about an immediate change, an immediate reduction in what we'll be getting or what we'll be able to do. In government, that is not typically what this means. Cuts is a word that applies to projections of future spending and the rate at which they can increase. So cuts does not mean a reduction. It often means slowing or stopping, usually slowing, future growth. And also important here, when I use the word growth to talk about public sector expansion, I am also talking about a retraction in the productive part of the economy. Because the only way that the public part can expand is by sucking off the private part, so to speak. Now, to be fair, here in New Hampshire, we are talking about $743 million being taken out of the budget from last year to this coming year. And this would affect a number of people in the public sector, for sure. For sure. So a couple of things that are in this budget, we're talking about, here's the heartstring pullers, $115 million in payments to hospitals caring for the poor. Now, obviously, we don't know how many hospitals that is. We don't have any idea what their total budget is or how much funding they get from the state. So we really can't gauge the impact of that. And it certainly doesn't, if you don't read it carefully, you would say, oh, $115 million being taken away from poor people. And I really don't think, you know, the most needy and desperate and dependent people is the place to start, slashing when you're trying to reduce the size of government. That's, you know, there's, if you look at corporate welfare, I think that is better, a better, for example, I'm sorry, I'm all over the place, but when we talk about changing the way healthcare works, the question you start with is, why is it so expensive to get healthcare? The first thing you do is not pass a law that bars people who need emergency medical assistance from emergency rooms, right? You address the root cause instead of just, hurting the people who have been sucked into being underneath this collapsing system and just let it collapse on them. But this bullet point gives us no indication, unless you don't read it carefully, that people in need are going to get any less services than they get currently. There's something about reducing welfare increases, and I do know people in this state who have been on welfare, and I'm telling you, it is a very lax system. People who are totally capable of being employed on the dole and living somewhat luxurious lives, considering how much effort it takes them to live that life. Most important one for me, makes workers in public unions at-will employees if a contract expires. That's the one I want to focus on here. I will add that it also says repeals law providing assistance to troubled youth. Well, that could tug a little bit at the emotions, but, you know, I do this show called School Sucks Podcast where I talk about what assistance to troubled youth usually looks like. How does somebody get
classified as a troubled youth. I also have several years of experience working in places that supposedly assist troubled youth, and it's not really a good scene, and it's not really assistance. So, all right, let's jump back to makes workers in public unions at will employees at if a contract expires. What does it mean to be an at will employee? Because we heard them say in the news report that this at-will employment status was the most controversial aspect of the bill for the unions. And it only happens if their contract temporarily expires. So for them to be that worried about it, this must be pretty serious. At-will employment means nothing more than an employment relationship where the employee or the employer can break the employment agreement with no liability. So basically, the relationship is voluntary. And public sector union employees do not want employers. And if you work in the public sector, your employer is theoretically the people. They do not want the people or the employer to be able to have that choice. Because that means that unionized workers would be potentially accountable for their actions. Now, of course, in the public sector, there's no profit motive, so employers are not really often keeping a close eye on the quality of the people they employ, but still, just the existence of that possibility, I think, is too much for them to have to deal with, even between a lapse in a contract and the renewal of a contract. This also goes into the issue of right to work and right to work laws in the United States. There are several states that are not what are referred to as right to work states, which means if you want to do a certain trade, like a certain skilled trade in construction, or if you want to be a teacher, you have to be in the union or you cannot do that job. Now, that sounds crazy, right? But the unions do have a supposed justification for why you would block somebody's right to work in a certain place. Unions who use the force and the guns of government to create conditions that are favorable to them, almost entirely at the expense of others, usually others who are productive, don't want other people in those trades to be able to reap the rewards of their aggression. So if you want to do that trade, meaning that you're going to benefit from the predation and the aggression of that union, you need to be in that union or you cannot do that job. Now, should employers have the right to only deal with unions if they want to? Yeah, if they're crazy. I mean, if they want a unionized workforce with political power, that's where I want all my employees to come from because, you know, if I look at the Midwest and I look at the public sector, that seems really efficient. But that person's going to go out of business. But they should have that right. So I don't think we need a law at all for or against the right to work. People should have a right to voluntary association, you know, in their personal or their professional lives. New Hampshire, by the way, is not a right-to-work state, which means you cannot be a teacher. You could not be a public school teacher if you did not want to join the union. But if you are an employee in the state of New Hampshire and you are not in a public sector union or some other politically protected union, you are an at-will employee. So at-will employment, voluntary relationships are a threat to these people. And one thing that I want to point out is that if you are an employee of a company, that is not your job. That is the company's job. It's a job that was created by somebody else that you are currently filling, that if something happens to you, somebody else can fill. When I worked for schools in the past, that was a job that I was being allowed to fill that was created by somebody else. And of course, me and my fellow workers had every right to get together and demand more favorable working conditions or better benefits, but the employer had every right to say, okay, then Friday can be your last day.
we didn't have a right to that employment, especially if we decided to stand outside and not do our job and hold signs and do three-word chants. I don't have a right to the money of my clients. Like, they have a choice as to whether or not they want to pay me based on what I do. So I have to do good. Right? So this entitlement to a job, this is part of, I really think, of our training in school, that, you know, you go into this place and somebody else will take care of you and meet these needs. That is a fallacy. Now, this whole situation is one issue. I mean, obviously, I expect these people who are in these unions to behave this way if they sense that there is a threat to this wonderful security that they enjoy, sort of in this vacuum, immune to whatever the economic conditions or the cutbacks or the layoffs or the desperation or the concerns of the rest of the country are, right? That they can operate in this little bubble free of accountability and susceptibility to any types of market forces. I expect that this is what they would do. What has surprised me about this whole situation, which, like this mold infestation, is spreading to New Hampshire, are the attitudes of young people. Because all of this pro-union stuff that's not accomplished by the use of force by the unions and their political allies is accomplished through the manipulation of language to get people to see this as a cause for the workers and the poor and the children. And unfortunately, in this country, in all 50 states, there are these centers that train children to be highly susceptible and vulnerable to pro-state, pro-aggression propaganda.
So it's around this time that I get my first iPod, and I start combing through iTunes, looking for podcasts, which were, as far as I knew, pretty new at that point. And I find the jackpot. The show is called 9/11 Synchronicity, and it was put together by this guy, a whistleblower, on something that he saw very suspicious going on in the World Trade Center in the months prior to 9/11. He was a software salesman, and he told what sounded to be a very legitimate story. If you can find the show, it's called 9/11 Synchronicity, and I suggest you go check it out if you're interested in this kind of stuff, because it's quite a story. And I go back to iTunes, and I'm looking for new 9/11 conspiracy theory shows. This is still probably 2006, and because I've got the 9/11 conspiracy theory shakes. I'm not getting my daily dose. So, you know, I turn away from that for a while. I discover what to this day I still think is a pretty good show called Common Sense with Dan Carlin. It's a political show. He's not really a root striker, but he says a lot of things that make a lot of sense, and I think it would be a really good place for a lot of people who are trying to explore some new ideas to start. I get into iTunes University. I start, you know, learning some things about that I didn't know about history or economics or politics, and I find that fascinating. Still pretty much a left-wing guy at this point. And eventually I just start sampling, like, you know, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And I discover the show Free Talk Live. Now, everything starts to change with this show. So I start listening to Free Talk Live. The things that they're saying at first are alarming, even to this conspiracy theorist that I am. And here I am listening to, Ian on Free Talk Live and being like, wow, this guy's pretty far out there. With some of the things that he's saying about government, because government is good. It just needs to be run by the right people. And that's where I was at the time. Now, so from there, I find some of Gardner Goldsmith's stuff. I find Complete Liberty, Wes Bertrand's show. And even at some point in 2007, I stumble across a show called Free Domain Radio. Now, I download three episodes of Free Domain Radio. I'm very selective, just kind of scrolling through all the titles, and I see Ron Paul's name mentioned a couple of times. So I download those shows.
And I hear this guy being very, very critical of the person that I decided that I wanted to support to be the president of the United States. And this guy is just taking all the wind out of my sails, telling me this is pointless to put all the eggs in this Ron Paul basket. And I say, enough of this guy. I'm not going to listen to this. I'm not going to sit here and listen to some Canadian insult Ron Paul. What does he care? And that was the last time I heard Free Domain Radio for probably a year. But why did I go for so much of this other stuff while at the same time rejecting somebody like Stefan Molyneux and what he had to say? Well, I was a graduate of government school and of a pretty heavily government-influenced higher education system in this country. So I had absolutely no information literacy. And I was also pretty good at running this internal editor in my mind where if somebody said something that I thought was interesting or intriguing or it fit with what I believed, I would assimilate that into my thinking. And if somebody like Stefan Molyneux came along and said, Ron Paul is a waste of time, I would reject it. So even though I had done all of this research and I felt like I was really just opening up doors that, you know, nobody else had been through before, I was still just like everyone else. Just instead of the religion of Republicans and Democrats, I was just in this religion of conspiracy. So Free Talk Live is compelling enough to keep me listening to it. You know, they have a good kind of back and forth where one guy is pretty much a voluntarist who at the time I thought was crazy. The other guy was more of a, you know, like a small government, minarchist, political libertarian, and he's the voice of sanity, and that keeps me listening. So then I read or listen to Wes's book, Complete Liberty, and I start, you know, listening to his podcast. The first show he does after the book is about 9/11, so I like that. And then I follow that forward a little bit more to, you know, the point where I hear him say some things about education. I hear him connect education, as I also heard on Free Talk Live, connecting education to this libertarian philosophy and explaining in very clear and consistent sounding ways why government education is bad. I'm introduced to the principle of non-aggression, the argument that the initiation of force is wrong, it is the ultimate moral failure, the argument that cannot be defeated. We are into 2008 at this point. The presidential election comes and goes. Guess what? Ron Paul doesn't get 10% of the vote, even from his own party. He is marginalized, he is ridiculed, he is defamed by the media. I was outraged by that. I couldn't believe that somebody who made so much sense would be rejected by the media. But I've learned a lot since then, and I learned a lot from then. Now, at this point in the show, we had a few technical snafus, so we just agreed that we would do our own conclusions or exits, one for School Sucks and one for Port Therapy. So I thought I would end today with a personal story. I'll try to make this quick. I remember being a much younger man and coming out of a long-term relationship and kind of being frustrated and sad and reflecting on it right after it ended. And I said something to myself or thought something to myself like, you know, you just can't change other people, but somehow they can always change you. This is a very kind of reactive, defeatist, poor me, unhealthy way of thinking. The more I reflected on that sentiment, the more I realized something very important about myself, that I was a conformist. I conformed to other people's desires,
and expectations and needs for a kind of romantic or emotional convenience. Conformity is something that we most certainly learn in school, but one of the reasons why we conform in these situations is so often because of dependence, something else that we learn very much in school. I'm so frustrated with myself for being compromised. But during the relationship, I'd always waited. I was always so hopeful. I always imagined that these compromises, this flexibility on my part would be reciprocated, that the favor would be returned. Of course, it never was, to my satisfaction anyway. And this nice girl that I had ended the relationship with probably felt the same way. But even though I was frustrated, I wanted to go forward. And I wanted to apply this lesson, this willingness to conform, and all of the dangers that go along with that, to my future. So as time went on and I matured intellectually and emotionally a little bit, and I stress a little bit, I met somebody else eventually that I was very interested in. And this time I came out full force. This is who I am. This is what I'm all about. Or so I thought. And the girl was more than happy with everything that I showed her, and we began a nice courtship. But I soon found that there was this exchange going on. I was getting very frequent, enthusiastic sex in exchange for my undivided attention and time. More attention and time than I had to give. I found a lot of the things that existed in my life around this relationship, my personal goals, my fitness goals, my professional goals, my hobbies, my interests, all kind of fading into the background. But it worked, it seemed anyway, for pushing the relationship forward. When we reached what I'll call, for lack of a better phrase, the point of no return as far as love and commitment was concerned, I started to assert my integrity. Let's throw some quotes around that word. I left a stable, steady, benefited, decent-paying, secure job to pursue this opportunity with this new tutoring company. For months, I made virtually no money. And we struggled, but she was supportive. It was around this time that I also started to make an effort to have my voice heard within the Liberty Movement, working on Wes's show, Complete Liberty. And I started to get more serious about all of this stuff than I had been in the past. It was about 8 months later that I began doing this show. During this time, I expected my new commitment, my new passion, this new intensity, to be greatly admired and respected. Like, these are the things that I've been talking about for so long. These issues, these problems, but now I'm doing something. I thought that that would be met with just the greatest admiration. But it wasn't. I mean, the words were there, but the real, genuine respect was not. Because all of this quote-unquote integrity had come too late to be appreciated. Because she had fallen in love with somebody else. Now, this is not some Desperate Housewives or Melrose Place type thing. She had fallen in love with a guy named Brett who looked exactly like me and talked exactly like me, but kind of came with this illusion that I had very much helped her create. When I reflect back to the beginning of the relationship, she was engaged in a similar type of charade, kind of probing me for what my interests were. Oh, I've always wanted to learn how to play golf. I've always wanted to learn how to play the guitar. I remember I was working a lot in Massachusetts at the time, and she would come to work with me, and she would ride down, and I would meet kids at the library all the way down in Needham, Massachusetts. It was a good hour and a half drive, and we would talk along the way and listen to this show
Free Talk Live that I was trying to get her into. And while I met with students at the library, she would get on the computer and research libertarianism. She would keep a notebook. She would take notes.
It seemed so magical, like a match made in heaven. Of course, heaven and magic are not real. A year later, a lot had changed. And for me, this time, there was no going back. There was no compromise here. This is who I was. This is what's important. I started to feel more satisfied than I ever had in my entire life. I felt like I was accomplishing something important. We continued to go through the motions of a loving relationship, get up in the morning, make coffee together, sit on the deck, talk, go for walks, go out to eat.
Well, at the same time, kind of subtly encouraging each other to return to the false advertising that we had done at the beginning of the relationship. So we kept moving along, but the clock was ticking. Eventually, the relationship came to a peaceful end, a hug, a few tears, and I was out. Now, what followed was very interesting. I immediately felt overcome by this sense of relief, by this feeling of freedom, and even by this pride in knowing that I had done something that was so hard just to do what was right. When I looked at my history with relationships, this was very unlike me. Now, of course, in this story, I can't reinvent myself as the hero, especially considering that I was doing, you know, a lot of things differently than I would have done when past relationships ended, where I would go out and try to mingle with women who I would never call my girlfriend, but I would definitely call at 1:30 in the morning. That old rebound thing. I withdrew from any kind of social life entirely and became very committed to reflecting not on why the relationship ended, but on why it began. What I've since discovered about myself has been enlightening and helpful, but at times very difficult and not always so easy to deal with. You know, and there's these flashes, these moments, there's these thoughts where, like, boy, same thing as before. It's like in 2 years, in the time I was with this person, I changed so much, and they didn't change at all. And why wouldn't they come with me? Why did they not understand the importance of this stuff? But even if all that's true, none of it matters. There's nothing more pointless and dumb and frustrating than spending a moment of your time trying to control what some other person did in the past. And that just leads to the worst kind of resentment. It's like having a 6-room house and renting 5 rooms out to people you have absolutely no control over, who just run around all day screaming about all the things you've done wrong in your life and all the people who've hurt you. Not a good living situation. And certainly not a good thing to have going on inside your head. Kid, there's nothing we can do about what other people did in the past. You know, the person we have the most sway, the most power with, is ourselves. And the only time that power can ever manifest is in the future. And I really felt like I was focused there. And I felt really good. Despite some hard times, I felt really good about how all of this played out. It reminded me of something that I had heard a while back. I think probably from Wes, either before or after we were recording a podcast, as we would just, you know, chat for 45 minutes on either side of the actual show. And it was something that I definitely read in the book Real Time Relationships much later. If you go down this path, like I said, not reinventing myself as a hero, because getting the questions answered about why the relationship started in the first place was tough. But going down this path, if we go into this seemingly never-ending Halloween party that begins in adolescence and ends for most people when they die, where everyone is all costumed up,
and we walk into the middle and we rip our costume off and we say, this is what I really look like, and I don't, I'm not ashamed of that. Party's over. When we do that, illuminating these situations, we'll see that, you know, a lot of people, they just scatter. It's frustrating, but it's so worth it. Because when we conform for the sake of convenience, we just get screwed, and not in a good way. And well, yeah, I guess, you know, there is a kind of loneliness for other people, and, you know, loneliness for companionship or whatever. Those feelings sure beat being lonely for ourselves. Thank you for listening, and take care. I'm so
let's put that one just on the back burner for a second. We also have the Reverend Ted Haggard, who got caught with male prostitutes and crystal meth. I don't know if this is helpful.
Yes. Reverend who?
Ted Haggard.
Haggard. ARD?
Yes.
Okay.
I'll do a Google on him as well.
He was caught with male prostitutes or just prostitutes?
Male prostitutes. Oh, look at that smile. I'm just going to start at Wikipedia. Scandal was publicized. Haggard entered 3 weeks of intensive counseling overseen by four ministers. In February of 2000, one of those ministers, Tim Ralph, said that Haggard is completely heterosexual. Ralph later said he meant that therapy gave Ted the tools to help his embrace his heterosexual side. I have good news. In February of 2011, he came out as bisexual. So, happy ending, kind of like alleviating maybe a little bit of the hypocrisy, maybe a little bit too late. But,
okay.
So we're focused more on the hypocrisy of these Republicans, I assume.
Absolutely. But, I mean, but we're going to be the hypocrisy of the Republicans and also Pope Fine Album, except we're going to use an incredibly gay witch to do it.
All right.
So, I mean, that's what the bit is.
Okay.
I'm typing here. And we're going to throw some off-color sexual humor in it too. Like, if we ask him, so why are you a Republican anyway? And he goes, well, Republicans like blowing up A-reds, and I like blowing A-reds too. You know, I mean, it can just be, he just totally misunderstands the Republican platform, and he just heard they like blowing up A-reds, and he likes blowing A-red men. And so he thought it would be a good fit for the party, for him to join it.
Okay, I'm revisiting your message from yesterday, which now will make some sense.
Yes, it's still horribly written.
We have Hocus Pocus going to a meeting of the Log Cabin Republicans. He knows about School Sucks, but was disappointed about it was not about glory holes in public schools. He wants to organize the Log Cabin into two groups, the Neo-Tops and the Neo-Bottoms. He is a Republican because of their policy about blowing up Arab men, and he loves blowing Arabs. He would also like to promote his new line of dong wands.
Yeah. His fabulous house of dong wands.
Which are dildos that he claims are magic wands.
Yes.
Okay. So...
go ahead.
So we'll do the, all right, so we've got the bathroom stall joke, that's a given. We have the blowing things up and versus blowing people. What else? You want? You want another one?
We have the the organizing of the Log Cabin Republicans into the neocons or neotops and neobottoms.
Yep. Can't.
We'll mention. Of course, he's already familiar with me and Taryn, and so we can introduce him to you. Hey, have you met Brett from School Sucks? And he's like, oh yeah, I listened to that show. I thought it was, and we can work in the public school glory hole in that. And he immediately turned off your podcast because it wasn't what he thought it was. And so, dude, he's sweet on Taryn. I think we ought to make him where he's really sweet on Taryn.
Okay.
Like flirts with him, obviously. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, and then Taryn can try to turn off his advances to him. And we'll do it like we're all in the same room here. Like Hocus just walks in. I have a door squeaking and applause, and we'll go, hey, welcome, Hocus Pocus, to the studio. And we'll just kind of BS with him a little bit. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like, we can ask him, what you been up to? And he's like, oh, I just opened up a fabulous house of Don Juan's. You know, and we can name a couple of his new Juan lines. So, what's a good name of a dildo?
Yeah, that would be the question. I don't know. What would be what are its characteristics? What do we want it to look like?
It's got to be magical and big.
All right, big. All right, let's see. So we want a name for a big dildo that also implies magic.
How about the Harry? And this is a play on magicians too. The Harry Pooper, part 1, 2, and 3. And we can play where it's got. No, that one won't. The Harry Pooper works instead of Harry Potter.
Yeah.
The Harry Pooper.
Harry Poudini.
The Harry Poudini. I like that better, dude. The Harry Poudini. Giant wand of something. Like the Harry Poudini giant wand of just something gay. What would a gay guy say right there? What's a good gay word? Like an over-the-top gay man say?
I don't know.
I mean, fabulous. The Harry Poudini giant wand of fabulous.
Okay.
But, I mean, that don't really matter. You know what I mean? So, nothing like that matters as long as we got some names of the wands. Mm-hmm. And Taryn will help us write some names. He's good at that, dude.
Okay.
So, we start out by going, what have you been up to? And he fills us in that he's opened up the fabulous house of bog wands. And it's, giant wand of, I already used fabulous, of, sometimes these are hard to do, man.
So we want to make sure that he understands, he also knows that we're talking about dildos. That's important. Do you think dong wand implies dildo?
Yeah, the dong wand, just from, and it may not. We're going to have to, dude, right there, he could go, well, right here, I just now brought one. I'll show you. It's the Harry Poudini. Look at here in my bag and pull it out, and you can go, Hocus, that just looks like a dildo. And you go, I mean, you know what I mean? He can just laugh and go, yeah, it does resemble that, doesn't it? Or something like that. But all of that stuff will work out, I think, in the bit.
Mm-hmm.
So. So there'll be a lot of ad libbing.
We also could maybe take it more. Is there any witch craziness right now, like in the mainstream culture? Like, I know we have vampires, that's big. Harry Potter's not really a witch, is he?
No, he's not a witch.
He's a wizard. So this person is a witch.
Yes. I don't know what would be the. The Tea Party lady was a witch.
Yeah.
But that's kind of old news.
Sure. Wiccan rhymes with Dickon.
Oh, That could be a great name of a dildo.
If it was like a two-ended dildo, you could call it the Wiccan Double Dickin.
I love it, man. The Wiccan Double Dickin. That's greatness, man.
Okay, so we're on a roll. We're doing well.
If it makes you laugh, dude, it's worth it. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Okay, so what have you been up, Hocus? And you can ask that, or I'll ask the first question, and then it'll go into his long deal of the fabulous House of Don Juan's, and he brought some samples for us, the Harry Poudini and the Wiccan Double Dickin. And you can go, that just looks like a double-headed dildo. And you go, oh, yeah, it's magical. Something like that.
Okay.
And then he'll be real excited about joining a political party. And he wanted to share that with us because we have a political podcast.
Okay.
And then we can start going, like you can go, so what did you join, Hocus? And they go, well, I joined the Log Cabin Republicans. And we can just go into the political talk after the dildo talk.
Political talk after the dildo talk. Okay.
Right.
The fact that these people are acknowledging that there's even a debate based on what kind of rights people have, based on their own personal choices, should occur to them that it's insane. Why would you align yourselves? Oh.
Dude, I agree with you 100%. But we can't get too political with Hocus.
Right. How long do you want this whole segment to be?
Does not matter.
What else do you want to cover on this show? Is this what you put all of your effort and thought into all week?
Yes. This, to me, this is what World Off Liberty is all about.
I agree.
I mean, oh, Dave, we got plenty of topics to talk about.
Yeah, like what? What do you think?
We could have a serious talk about the Log Cabin Republicans after the bit.
Sure.
I mean, that'd be a fantastic topic, dude. And talk about how there's absolutely no gay rights on either of the mainstream parties, and unless you want to join the freedom movement, unless you want to become an anarchist or voluntarist or whatever fancy word that somebody created this week is. You know, that's the only way you're going to ever have equal rights as a gay person.
Right.
Because we don't believe in voting away your rights, dude. That's the main thing right there. It don't matter if you're Christian, atheist, gay. It's just your own life, dude. So to me, it's a no-brainer that everybody ought to come into this party. The blacks, the gays, Mexicans, anybody like that ought to just be so on board with liberty, man.
So that could also be a good third segment. Like, the first segment can be this horror show that you've planned. The second segment, we can talk about the Log Cabin Republicans and you know, why we think that, of course, people with, you know, these divergent lifestyles who are just, like, seeking, for lack of a better, in their understanding anyway, equal treatment under the law, which is what I think is kind of insulting, that there's even a debate about who has what rights based on their lifestyle choices or their personal preferences. And then maybe in the third segment, we could talk about what's the hesitation? What do we feel is keeping people aligned with these two insane, hypocritical political parties?
I like that, dude.
All right.
I mean, I think that's a pretty relevant topic, man, you know. One that you don't really hear discussed that often either.
Right.
So, I mean, honestly, Brett, why is it that, I mean, realistically on Facebook, dude, I have one black friend that's in the liberty movement. One. And you look back at their lives and what the government's done to their grandparents and everything like that with those silly laws that they had on their heritage, dude. And then they're just going, man, I'm gonna vote Democrat because they're for the black man. And it's just not true, dude.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Well, I think it's something that, yeah. You know, I mean, everybody, I just actually got off the phone with this woman. We were talking, her name was Laurette Lynn, and she does a, she runs a site called The Unplug Mom, and we talked about, you know, how just this authority worship is just self-perpetuating one generation after another. So it's not even like for any special interest group that's based on a lifestyle choice or any ethnic minority, it's not about self-hatred. It's just about the same obedience that we're all trained in, you know? So
sure.
I don't think it's anything distinct about any particular group. I just think, I mean, you know, that's what school and society and culture engenders in people, and
I put myself like in the shoes of I cannot imagine, Brett, though, and I'm not going to mention this on the podcast. This is between us, dude. I went to the inner city of Memphis and was working on a charity cause to hand out clothing and stuff, and dude, I was in the projects, government housing, and there was 4 and 5 generations of just poverty-stricken black people that did, I mean, they grew up in such a way that they didn't even know that what they was doing was sponging off the government anymore. Mm-hmm. They didn't know that they were even sponges. That was the life that they knew, and that's all that they knew. It's been that far removed to where it's not a handout anymore. It's a straight entitlement, and that's all that they know. It's like they cannot, not black people, this happened to be black people that I was dealing with, but they could not come to grips with getting out of that.
Right.
Because it's all that they know. And, dude, I mean, in southeastern Oklahoma, you see that a lot. I mean, just poor, dirt poor people. They live in a dilapidated trailer house. They get food stamps. They go to the store and buy hot dogs and get a check on the first of the month in order to buy cheap beer, and they're happy. That's all that they want in life.
Yeah.
And they're entitled to that, dude. And it's sickening, but they don't know any other way besides that.
Right.
So, you know, it's just, I guess the government worked on that. I guess they succeeded in what they wanted to do because they got people dependent upon them. And that's people that's always going to keep them in power right there.
Yep, that's exactly what we talked about. That's exactly what we talked about, is that kind of dependence. And, I mean, that's what perpetuates the school system. I mean, it's that dependence that you learn that you're helpless and you learn that you're small, and then you look at this other group as if it's big and magnificent, and you become dependent on them, and you teach that to the next generation, and in so many ways, because of the way you learned, you're trapped in that dependence. Yeah, it's just like, yeah, that's a really interesting story.
But I think that would be a really good topic, dude.
Yeah. That would have been an awesome podcast right there.
Oh, no doubt, man. Usually the best ones are when we're discussing the podcast.
Oh, wait a minute. Hold on. I called you back on Skype because my phone was about to die. Skype recorded it, so we could do I'll edit out whatever the name of that. I don't want to mention that guy's name, and I'll edit out what you just said. And we could put that out as like a behind the scenes if you want.
Yeah. You don't even have to edit it out because, I mean, I didn't say anything bad. So.
Oh, no. I'm saying edit that. You said you didn't want to talk about it on the show, so I didn't know if you didn't want it. I don't know. But
no.
Okay, yeah, but I'll edit that guy's name out, whoever that guy is. Yeah, that show fucking sucked.
Oh, no doubt, dude. Me and Mike got so drunk, and, dude, we were loaded and sitting at the baseball park in downtown Oklahoma City and called into that show. And, dude, there was a lot of static one time, and one of the hosts goes, "What was that?" And I go, "Oh, that was me. I was just adjusting my cock ring." And they're all like, "What?" And man, it was so wheels off. It was the craziest interview ever on that, man. I told Mike, I said, "You watch, I'm gonna throw cock ring in." Like, every time we've done an interview, dude, one of us will go, "All right, you gotta say this." And you gotta work it in the conversation. But Mark interviewed us and I got in. Mike said, tell them that it looks like a Tulsa Children's Theater stores their sock puppets in your pants. So I worked that in the conversation on Free Talk Live. It was greatness, man.
So you want to get Taryn into this?
Yeah, I'll give him a call real quick. And I'll call you back on your cell phone. Is this working yet?
Yeah, I'm charging it right now.
Okay, I'll give you a call back on it.
Makes me happy.